church, there were some windows. And inscribed on the windows were these words: "Dwell in this holy place." And secondly, "My house shall be a house of prayer." I've thought about that many times since seeing it over the last few weeks, and I came to the conclusion that in that little church, it was indeed a holy place and a house of prayer, because the people who sat there sometimes lingered after the service to pray. And they were always there early. They were eager, it seemed, to come to the holy place and to make it a place of expressing their concerns, offering their prayers. I do not propose to say your prayers for you this morning, but I would hope that you might let me direct your thought as we make this a holy place and a place of prayer. To that end, would you bow with me? And would you offer a prayer to God for your own spiritual growth and development? Would you pray for patience and durability in your ministry? Would you pray for an understanding of what it means to be faithful to Him? Father, we pray Thee that the thoughts and the meditations of our hearts may be acceptable in Thy sight. O Lord, our strength and our Redeemer. Amen. For the first time in 1958, I heard Dr. Staley, then president of Southeastern Seminary, stand in the chapel service and say to us, "Gentlemen, this morning, I want to talk to you about unbundled hay." And I thought, uh-oh, he didn't have time to prepare. So he's just going to toss some ideas together, and I was a little afraid of what we might get that morning. But I heard that same statement and heard him do that several times while I was a student. And I think without exception, those times proved to be highlights in chapel for me. Because quite obviously, each time he did it, he had given thought and probably prayer to what he wanted to say. And the thoughts which he was expressing, although they might not have been tied together very well, and they were like unbundled hay, were incisive. And they led us to think. After 14 years, because the first time was October 1957, when I had any responsibility for leadership in chapel, I read the scripture that year in a series of student meetings we had with a revival, with a preaching emphasis with Dr. Herring. Since that time, over the next 2 years, I led the prayer once in chapel, and then I spoke 1 year while a student. Since that time, I've appeared in one way or another in chapel 21 times at Southeastern Seminary. And over that period of time, it's taken me 14 years and 21 appearances and a few missed ones to find some unbundled hay. But I want to do that this morning, with all the risks that are involved. I've got three little piles of unbundled hay this morning, all three of which I have manuscripts for, and all three of which I have prepared at one time or another for presentation in this chapel, and all three of which I never either had the nerve to present, or for some reason or other I decided something else was better. I want to stimulate your thought in three areas this morning with the hope that you might preach your own sermon, that you might think about these things, that you might be motivated to some good through them. The first might be labeled with a question. And the question is there any fear in this place. 2 years ago, before John Durham went on his sabbatical, I talked with him about an idea I had concerning a sermon in this chapel. And I talked with him about what he understood the idea of fear from a theological perspective to mean and to be in the Old Testament. And I tried to prepare what I thought would be a meaningful presentation from that perspective and from the perspective of a psychologist friend of mine who talked to me about fear from a psychological point of view. I was interested to ask the question, is there any fear in this place? Meaning, are we motivated because of what the Old Testament calls the fear of God in terms of awe and in terms of reverence, in terms of constructive motivation that comes out of that kind of theological understanding of fear? While at the same time, I was interested to say that I am disturbed by the fact that fear can be psychologically intimidating. Sometimes it can cause you to do things which are not your best. It can cause you to be less constructive than you would like to be. And my aim was at that point to apply that theological and psychological interpretation of fear to what goes on in this place. Some questions for you. Those of you who have spoken in this chapel have often asked the same questions I've asked. Can you imagine yourself this morning, whether having spoken or whether perhaps having an invitation to this morning, can you imagine yourself the speaker, the leader? How do you feel? I've often asked my colleagues here how they felt, what their psychological reaction was to the opportunity to speak in this chapel. Examine your own attitude if you had the responsibility this morning. Would you be happy? Would you be eager and enthusiastic? Would you feel intimidated? Would you be fearful, frightened? It's a good question. It's unfortunate, I think, that sometimes when the speakers in this chapel stand, one of the first things they do, and I kept a record for a while when I was preparing that sermon, one of the first things many of them do is say, I'm scared. Or in some way or other indicate that they feel uncomfortable in this situation. Imagine yourself to be the worshiper this morning. And you are, you know. What did you expect of me when you came? With what attitude did you come to this place this morning? How will you look upon and think about what I say? What approach will you take to what I may do for and with you this morning? To put it in a nutshell, how much influence do you think you have in this place this day? As a participant in chapel, how much influence will you have the next time you stand here? Because of your own understanding of the fear and the reverence and the awe which we ought to have for God in this place, or because of your frightened psychological mood at the moment. We all have a part in it, do we not? How long has it been since you prayed for the man who stands in this pulpit when you enter? How friendly an atmosphere do we create by our open attitude and our encouragement to those who stand here? I would hope that all of us would remember that there is fear in this place. And it ought to be a constructive fear, motivated on the part of the speaker and on our part because we've come to be helpful to one another. That's one pile of hay. Think about it. Do what you wish with it. I hope it will motivate you to be prayerful for those who stand here. The second pile of hay I would call effective ministry and quality theological education take time. 1 Timothy 4:7 in the New English Bible reads, "Keep yourself in training for the practice of religion." In Moffat's translation, it reads, "Train for the religious life." The simple point is that 3 years and an MDiv degree is no ticket and free pass assuring you of effective ministry or of a high educational experience. 5 years, 10 years, or 20 years involved in ministry here, there, or somewhere else does not assure you that your ministry is going to be effective and meaningful. In the words of an essay I read in the title of a book by the same name of the essay, "Real Living and Real Ministry Takes Time." Spiritual growth and formation have for years been a major thrust of Catholic theological education. They have been strong upon the fact that the minister ought to be required and ought to understand how to develop his spiritual life. To use their term, he ought to be spiritually formed in the process of the educational experience. While Protestants at the same time have recognized that an effective relationship to the world and to the church is important to effective ministry. And now I learn from visits and conversations that we're finally blending the two. Recognizing that effective ministry and meaningful education requires spiritual growth and formation at the same time it requires long, patient effort on the part of the minister. Like the athlete, I suppose, according to the statement in 1 Timothy, we are as strong as our daily exercises. And like the good Catholic priest, our minister in training, we need to remember that the spiritual exercises of our daily lives determine how strong we are ultimately, not any one thing we do. Few good things develop rapidly. I listened to the lady in the hospital yesterday who told me, when I asked her how she happened to become ill, she said in these words, "Well, it just come on me kind of slowly." Spiritual maturation and effective ministry seldom come on us rapidly. More often they come to us and on us and in us slowly, by patient endurance. I hope you will reflect upon the fact that your educational experience here and your effectiveness long term as a minister will depend upon whether you keep yourselves in training for the religious life. That's the second pile of hay. And the third one, I would like to title, "Keep the Faith." Strange sentence. I sat about 3 weeks ago in the lower mall at North Hill Shopping Center on one of those wooden benches, taking my position intentionally so that I might be near to a rather motley-looking group of people. With long hair and whiskers for most of them and ragged clothes, I had been told about them by Ed Brandon, the president of the shopping center, who had expressed keen interest in them and what they were saying. I listened. I eavesdropped. I heard some of their conversation, and I watched intently as they left each other a few minutes later. The first two who left turned to the others, the rest of the group, and said to them simply as they left, "Keep the faith." The next day, I was driving in my car on a Sunday morning and turned on the radio, and a black minister was preaching. A very enthusiastic sermon, obviously involved with and concerned about what he was saying. And as he preached, I noticed that he continued to use the phrase, and he got amens from the congregation as they encouraged him to preach even more warmly, enthusiastically. He continued to say, "Brethren, you've got to keep the faith." A few days after that, I watched a minister in one of our churches stand with his suit and his vest on and announce his topic. And his topic was, keep the faith. It's interesting, isn't it? Three very diverse, different groups with different understandings, perhaps, of what the faith is for them at that moment, but all concerned and somehow sensing that the thing that bound them together and that motivated them and that is important at the moment is that they keep the faith. I've tried to think about what each of those meant. What did the group of young people in the North Hills Mall really mean? I don't know what all they meant, but among the things they meant was that they felt they needed to continue to offer encouragement to each other. Whatever the principles they're basing their action and their conversation and their lives on, they're important to them. And those principles bind them together, and they cement their relationships with each other. And they're saying to each other, keep on believing and keep on acting in a certain way. Keep on keeping the faith, and as long as you do and as long as we do, we'll have a meaningful relationship to each other, and we'll continue to try to do what we think is important to do. And the black minister, he said that morning, in essence, as he preached and as I listened, to keep the faith means, brethren, in a simple way, you're going to come to church and you're going to pay the preacher in his words, and you're going to stay away from sin. And with the necessary warmth and enthusiasm which he felt to express what he wanted to say, he was encouraging people to remember that to keep the faith meant to keep on believing and to keep on acting and to keep on doing what seemed to them to be important to stability and spiritual growth in life. And my friend who stood with the same topic, in an intelligent and coherent way, he said, to keep the faith means to realize that there are principles, there are truths which we've inherited, which we've learned, which are still of great value to us. But it also means that in a contemporary world, in contemporary culture, in a changing world, we'll continue to examine and re-examine our faith and what it ought to cause us to do in this world. And to keep the faith, he said, means more than reciting it. It means doing it. What does it mean to keep the faith? I would hope that my faith, which I try to keep, is something of a combination of all three of those. I would hope that I never lose my enthusiasm for my relationships with people which are meaningful. And that I can keep those enduring relationships because of the friendship and because of the concern we hold mutually as we live and act in a world that sometimes is hostile to us, that doesn't want to listen to us. I hope by the same token that in my keeping of the faith and in yours, I never lose my enthusiasm and warmth for that which has been given to me and for that which remains meaningful in my own spiritual life and development. And I hope by the same token, I'll never quit thinking about the faith. And I hope we'll never quit doing it. In the spirit of Jesus, when he talked with Peter, who was confused and frustrated because of what the Lord had said he was going to do, Jesus, turning to him, knowing about the hard days that were ahead, and about how frightened he would be, and about the fact that he would have to endure in order to have effective ministry, and that it would be very difficult for him to maintain his faith in his Lord, he looked to Peter and said simply in Luke 22, I pray that your faith may not fail. Is it possible to sweep the three bundles into one stack in a meaningful way? I think so. I think it's possible to do it with a story and a hymn. Some of you have read Luckock's book in the minister's workshop, and you've been reminded of that ingenious lady whose name was Scheherazade, who told the stories according to the legend which make up the Arabian Nights. The origin of the stories is attributed to the king, who married many brides in succession and always beheaded them the next morning. Each bride came to the wedding chamber filled with fear because she knew what her fate was to be. And filled with fear, she was caused to be ineffective as a companion. Finally, he married Scheherazade, who turned out to be more than a glamour girl. She had wit and resourcefulness. She told her lord and temporary husband on her first night with him a story of such enthralling interest and suspense that the execution was postponed for a day so that he might hear what happened next. The next installment was equally gripping and unfinished, so the execution was again deferred, to be followed, we're told, by 1,001 nights of storytelling. Here was a life preserved by the sheer interest of a story, maybe with fear, maybe because she was having a good time being an effective storyteller. That is not an unrealistic picture of the contemporary minister. Often his effective ministry, and that's an important phrase in that sermon I wrote, often his effective ministry is prolonged by his ability to wear well rather than to wear out. And in many situations where the minister has not learned patience and consistency and careful witness, his execution is ordered at dawn. Let him who enjoys complacency and has no fears be aroused by the story of Scheherazade. And let him remember, in the words of Joseph Conrad, the stuff that comes easy is dull reading. And if you'll permit me an ecclesiastical postscript, the ministry that comes easy is dull ministry. It wasn't long before that early church recognized that durability was important to effective ministry, and so it said, employ bishops and deacons worthy of the Lord, truthful and tested men. And in the words of Bridgeton and Culver, in the study they did of the training of ministers, the minister recognizes his personal identity. He knows what motivates him. He knows where his strengths and weaknesses are, what to fear, where to move confidently. And then he goes about his business, ministry. And the hymn, listen. Take time to be holy. Speak oft with thy Lord. Make friends of God's children. Help those who are weak. Forgetting in nothing his blessing to seek. And you're going to pronounce the benediction this morning. I hope you'll think, but there is an invitation. After the singing of the hymn, you're invited without fear and with fear. You're invited without hurry to take time to be holy, to renew your faith, to keep it in this place. Some of you are like I am. After chapel, you always have 10:30 appointments. But some of us do not. What will this place be like today for us? Friendly, comfortable place of worship? It can be. We'll sing the hymn. After the singing of the hymn, we will all remain for the brief postlude. And then you're invited to stay, to take time to be holy. If you need to leave, you may leave with the choir and the organist. Number 367.